Let's, without further hesitation, let's turn to the interview with Mike Koplinka-Lair. It took place this past Tuesday and aired originally on the morning show, which is a show that I periodically guest host. So we'll turn to Mike now. You know Mike Koplinka-Lair as a former school board member and a leader in the social service community, as well as the chair of our county legislature in recent years. And now he's on to new things, and he's going to talk about his experiences as a father and as a son of a strong father, and as a member of this community, and what it means to be and make a home here. You're going to start out with the question that everybody winces at: is who are you?
Ah, good morning,
Mike. It's good to have you here, and I'm glad that you could make this time.
Thank you for having me on. Well, you say Mike Koplinka-Lair, but yeah. Actually I was born Mike Lair and got married to Carrie Koplinka, so we hyphenated 32 years ago. But as a young person, I grew up in a family of eight, a Catholic family. And
a local family?
Well, raised since age 11 in Ithaca.
Okay,
yep.
Okay.
Born in Cleveland and moved to Kansas and then eventually landed in Ithaca because my father was a professor at Cornell. So we had four kids of our own, Carrie and I. But growing up in a family of eight, you know, I was a middle child, so learned a lot about cooperation and getting along and working things out. I think that certainly informed who I am and who I have been all along in my public life in Ithaca. Probably two key things are my two parents. My dad contributed through engineering, and my mom contributed through a lot of human services and social services programs here in Ithaca. So that combination of parents obviously impacted who I am today. But my public life, so to speak, in Ithaca after coming back from college has been pretty much focused on community service, public service in a lot of different ways. Been involved in nonprofit organizations, been involved in government, been involved in community building. So between all those things, my own family of origin and having four kids of our own and being very deeply entrenched in this community, trying to make it a better community, I think that's a lot of who I am and who I have
right,
become.
Right. And kind of one of the counterintuitive things, people of our generation, I mean, we're about the same age, have surprisingly, when they had strong community ties to begin with, have surprisingly ended up pretty close to where they started from. And that's been pretty true of you and a number of your siblings.
That's right. We have, again, I mentioned eight kids, but four of the eight still are in Ithaca. And call it their home and really continue to make that kind of contribution.
Right. And that kind of a generational commitment to place is disappeared in the late 20th century and began to in the mid 20th century and began to reemerge for some of us. Myself, I have five generations of my ancestors are buried 6 miles from each other, but that's that's 1,200 miles from here, or 1,000 miles from here in Missouri. And I'm one who moved, so I'm the back. I'm out of step with these things. So what I'm going to do is, Mike gave a couple of songs, and I'm going to play one of them, and it's Father and Son by Cat Stevens. You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and we are talking with Mike Koplinka-Lair about his life, and this next selection is a piece of music that he picked by Cat Stevens, Father and Son.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. to explain. When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
I ask guests routinely to bring some of the music that captures a piece of their life or a piece of their work, a piece of their spirit. And Mike, why'd you bring that?
Why did I bring that in? That theme of father and son, I would say, dominates my challenge growing up. Again, being one of eight and having a father who was kind of an engineer mentality and worked a lot. That song, and I think Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle, we played right. That a lot growing up in terms of how much access we had to our father, how much he, you know, let his hair down and played, and how much we, of course, wanted to experience more of that exuberance of life, which we weren't quite getting in that emotional content. And so I think that informed who I married. It informed, you know, how I interacted with my own kids, kind of as a bit of a counterbalance or a
so what
pendulum
did you
swing.
Do what did you do to make it different for you and your kids and your spouse?
Yeah, I was just actually talking to a friend about this the other day, that there's probably three key things I did. One was, we did not have television when we had kids, and so we really spent a lot of time with our kids, not having the boob tube, so to speak, babysitting them. We also both work part-time, and so we somehow decided to lower our expenses, to not have to be on this treadmill of earning money to make it, but we actually chose very consciously to decrease our expenses so we'd have time with the kids, even though that meant having a little bit more economic challenge, but more time. And then, you know, just play. You know, I can remember being on the floor with my kids crawling all over me, kids sitting on my lap at dinner time all the time with their fingers in my face and all kinds of stuff like that. Just much more human contact, much more poking and walking through the woods, you know, biking up to the airport, looking at airplanes, all kinds of activities around engagement and playing together. So that was, again, kind of a pendulum swing or counterpoint to not having as much time with my own dad as I had hoped to have.
Right. And I guess I want to go back to the music, and then I want to go back to your family a little
yeah.
bit. But on the music, did your dad listen to the music that you were listening to?
No, and matter of fact, when I think of Harry Chapin, Cats in the Cradle, we used to crank that. We used to play it really loudly to kind of get under my dad's skin, and he would, like, leave the room, or he'd go someplace else, because he kind of knew the point that we were trying to dig there around, hey, Dad, spend more time with us. But I don't think, no, I think it was foreign to him, and I think he didn't really spend a lot of time looking at the emotive content of what we're trying to reach for. So it was a challenge. He obviously was a huge breadwinner for a family of eight, so he had a lot to be thinking about.
Right. It sounds also to the, in some ways, you know, modernity and gender role differentiation was much stronger.
Oh yeah.
Through the 19th and 20th century than it may have been centuries before,
mm-hmm.
Where men worked more from home and were more an integrated part of their family's daily life, hour
yeah.
by hour.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's what you tried to create in your own setting. With Carrie.
Yeah, and Carol came and did a book about, what was it, the 150th anniversary of City of Ithaca? But anyway, I remember writing when I was home with the kids.
Oh.
I wrote a piece in that book around what it was like to be one of the first, not the first, but one of the first men who was home with the kids consciously, while Carrie, you know, at that point she worked more full-time and I was home full-time,
mm-hmm.
house husband, so to speak. And I added my contribution, I forget what year that was, you know, 78 or something like that.
Right. No, and it was while it would not necessarily have been as noteworthy a decision in other times.
Yeah.
My mother was raised by her father after her mother died of a long bout with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we have actually several generations where the fathers didn't remarry, but they raised the kids and farmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could do those things, especially when the kids were old enough that they could help a little bit.
Neat.
Now, how has your relationship with your children different now? Because they're all essentially grown. The youngest one just graduated from college.
That's right.
And how is your relationship different with them now? How do you think that is because of what you did?
Well, first of all, we're, I think, much more close emotionally. We really worked hard to be in touch with what they were feeling each day. I can remember our son Sam, who was the youngest of our four, coming home off the bus and literally being there with a glass of orange juice, because we had this understanding that he would kind of fall apart. He would kind of hold it together in school, but as soon as he got off the bus and walk up the street to the house, it was kind of like, I can't hold life together anymore. And so we had to kind of give him a little glass of orange juice, give him a little sugar injection, and I would wrestle with him all the time. So the physical contact, the emotional contact, I think has played into our present day relationships, where we are very much in touch that way.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we're in this transition, of course, from adult child relationship to adult or peer peer.
Right.
That's right. I'm actually trying to encourage some of my kids to call me Mike as opposed to Dad. You know, two of them have kind of said, we're not going to do that, Dad. And the other two said, we can experiment with that. So trying to, who knows, long, maybe it'll take a couple of decades for that to really sink in.
And does it matter to them? Does it need to matter to them the way it matters to you?
Right.
And what are you saying?
It's as much symbolic about, we are peers on this journey of life, as opposed to a hierarchical relationship, mm-hmm. with the power imbalance that sometimes can happen with parents and children.
Right. Although, I guess, and if you see it in a hierarchical form, then it is a terribly problematic thing. But if you see it as a status, the meaning of which changes, because a young dad is somewhat inexperienced, green,
mm-hmm.
awkward, not particularly adept. With time, hopefully, that becomes something more skillful, so that maybe there is a little bit of a functional as opposed to a formal hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in life, kids often step in roles that do for their parents what they can't do for themselves. So I'm pushing you a little bit on that, just to allow for an organic quality rather than a formal.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to step out of the rigidness of the roles.
Yeah.
I even this weekend I was thinking to myself, there's something that I was expecting to do on Labor Day, for instance, coming up. I thought, this is how my Labor Day is going to go. And then one of the kids said, well, why don't we spend a little bit more of Labor Day together? And my first reaction was, absolutely not. I've got a plan, and then within a minute or so, I realized, that's interesting. I actually do have Labor Day off. I could spend it more with some of my kids. It's nice that I'm being bumped or encouraged in this way, as opposed to we were going to be at family gathering and I wanted to come back to Ithaca earlier than they're proposing. So the rigidity is what I'm trying to look at in terms of definition of role and trying to step out of that.
You're just trying to check your reactions too.
Yeah.
That's another way of just kind of what is my first impulse and
And for the young people in my life, you know, our kids, how are they placing me in that role so that they can step out of it as well?
You know? Right, right, right. And in some sense, you're shaping each other.
Yeah.
And that's tricky because it takes some skill for it not to be a matter of. It's hard sometimes for parents to give up roles, but it's also hard for children to take them on without feeling like they're being unduly aggressive or critical.
Yeah, yeah. Well, our kids aren't having a problem with that. They're stepping right into
stepping
it.
Right into
push,
the
push,
role.
Push. Yeah, nudge,
yeah.
Nudge.
Yeah, and one of the things that came to my mind, and because we haven't really talked about this topic, although we've known each other for a dozen or more years, how is it? You know, how is it with boundaries when you're that emotionally involved? You know, one of the cry from parents and to some extent from children who've grown up in more traditional families where there wasn't that that amount of time investment, especially around play and what's going on in your interior emotional life. There's oftentimes a sense of a disconnect. They don't really know how to talk about what matters. They don't really know how to just physically be comfortable in each other's presence, comfortable in your own skin. But some people worry about going the other extreme.
Sure.
Do you kind of have? Are you too active in each other's lives, or is even that a silly question? I just throw it out there because that was one of the things I think listeners might react to.
Well, I think there's different personality types. I mean, Carrie, my wife, and I would answer this question very differently. I think
that I would testify too, just from knowing a little bit of both of you.
I think I'm very good with boundaries. I think partly because of my father's training around or an engineering mind. Personality type, I'm able to set limits. I'm able to walk away from an emotional quote drama and say good luck with that, as opposed to someone else who may get more drawn in and say, wow, that's still swirling. I want to put that into a package and make it more tidy. And I'm more realistic around, well, that's those two people's issue. I don't have to get embroiled in that or whatever.
Right. Right, and then there's a middle ground, which is what's going on here? What does this look like?
Yeah,
which is yet another set of skills.
Yeah, and I'm not always needing to resolve it right then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm right. Glad to think about it and come back.
Right, and let things be messy.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, no, but it's a useful skill because we do tend to want to. A lot about the roles, the boundaries, and the role segment, specialized roles and stuff, was a way to say we're not going to have conflict because somebody is clearly the expert on this particular issue, Dad is this or Mom is that or whatever, and so you don't cross into each other's spheres and the boundaries are tight. But when you live in a more fluid relationship, no one is the expert.
Yeah,
and everybody is at the same time.
I think we've all been socialized. We have middle class socialization. We have Protestant, Catholic. So, what's expected, what's quote normal, can now be questioned and thrown out the window and negotiated and played with a little bit. And I think our kids are very good at that. And I think thankfully, Carrie and I generally are pretty good with that too.
Good. This is WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make our and break our lives. And today's guest is Mike Kaplinka-Lehr. He's been talking about his role, particularly as a father, and how he's tried to make up for some of the absence that his father had in the family and the real hierarchical kind of authoritarian position that his father had, so that he can be more of a friend and a playmate and also a peer, but as he moves out of being a person on whom his children depend, he can also become more of an equal to them. And what we're going to do now is we're going to cut to a song that we didn't play in the interview this past week when we had him on the morning show. We're going to play the song from Harry Chapin, Cats in the Cradle, that he and his siblings used to crank up and try to get their dad to respond to, but he wouldn't.
And one, and two, and one, two, three, four. My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it. And as he grew, he said, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know I'm gonna be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and a silver's born. Little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when. We'll get together then, son. You know we'll have a good time then. When my son turned 10 just the other day, said thanks for the ball and come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today, I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay, and he walked away, but a smile never dimmed. I said, I'm gonna be like him, yeah, you know I'm gonna be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver's gone, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you're coming home, that I don't know when, we'll get together then. Just the other day, saw much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you, can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later, can I have them, please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little ball blue and the man in the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know. Gonna have a good time. Well, I've long since retired. My son's moved away. Called him up just the other day. Said I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids are the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as he hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cat's in the cradle and a silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. We're gonna have a good time then.
You're listening to WRFI Community Radio for Ithaca and Watkins Glen, 88.1 in Ithaca, 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And today we're talking with, this is the Made of Clay Report with Eric Clay, and today my guest is Mike Kaplinka-Lair, who's been talking about his role as a father and his family, but now we're going to shift gears over to into his work in the community. And this next segment will be dealing with many his new roles as he's come into them in recent years. So you've had, you know, you went away to college, you came back, did a graduate degree in Ithaca, and then you stayed. What keeps you here?
Well, I think Ithacans in general, I would say Tompkins County Inns, invest very heavily in community. They want to build community. I think there also are considerable challenges across the place, you know, rural versus what you might call urban here in Tompkins County, issues of race, issues of class. So we have this urge, this sense of place and geography that people are really drawn to. I mean, I used to work temporarily, interim director of the DeWitt Historical Society, and I remember Gretchen Soxie was doing an exhibit around the spirituality of this place, mm-hmm. spirituality of the lake, and First Nations peoples who were here, and why were they drawn to this particular spot in terms of, you know, the universe is drawing them, the power of the water and the land. And so I think there is a power of that for Tompkins County people, but also a commitment to, once we're here, how do we build community in this little bit of a nest that's been made by a glacier, so to speak, at the bottom of a lake. And I think there's that will and commitment to make community, and the unfortunate separations that we always have to keep working to get past. But there are separations. Mm-hmm. Whether you're, you know, from a farming family or from an academic family, there's these voids that we want to try to reach past and learn from, but they also can separate us. So both those things, I think, are what keep me here: the challenge of it, mm-hmm. and the commitment of so many people to make this a better community, generation after generation.
And it's a much changed community. We're the only county in upstate New York that's doubled in population in the last 60 years. In fact, we're the only one that's substantially grown.
Yeah.
And in those same 60 years, we went down very early to less than 1% farm population, people making a living off the land,
right.
Which is much lower than most of the rest of the United States and much of upstate New York. And all of those things are changing a little bit. So we're a community where the multi-generational residents are a tiny fraction of the overall group. And so we do have to figure out how to do instant community.
Yeah, and, you know, even though I've been here since age 11, I'm still not considered a townie, absolutely.
Right,
so
right.
What does it mean to still keep learning from our elders, from our ancestors, so to speak, and what this place means, but also to keep reinventing it with thoughtfulness. So
what you're working right now with an organization called Rescue Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that, you know, what, how did that transition in your work life happen, and what does it mean?
Yeah, so I've been involved in human services for a long time, been involved in government for a long time, public service very generally,
school board, county reps. Yeah,
that's right. And more recently, was involved with Cooperative Extension and doing energy efficiency. But I wanted to get back into human services, and had been involved with issues regarding people at the margins pretty regularly, been involved with issues of race and class, as I mentioned. And the opportunity to work with people who are homeless here in Tompkins County became available. The Rescue Mission has been operating up in Syracuse for 125 years, way back when the Erie Canal was being built. That was some of the instigation initiative of people getting involved in lives of people who are
so that's almost 200 years ago. That's like 180, yeah.
Yeah.
90 years, yeah.
And then they began to expand in Binghamton, Auburn, and Ithaca in the last 3 to 4 years, but they really have a legacy in Syracuse. And then Rescue Mission was actually invited into the community when the issues with the jungle were pretty rampant in this community. Of course, the jungle's been going for probably almost, I would say, 20 years, but more recently a former mayor wanted to empty the jungle in some way because there was some real challenges around drug issues and death in the jungle, so they wanted to see if they could move people out. But a group of people in the community, based out of Community Faith Partners particularly, decided, let's actually build relationship with people in the jungle.
So just not relocating them.
That's right. But through building relationship, look at what supports they might need, what challenges are going on in their life, and then work with that. And over a period of time, I would say between 18 months and 2 years, they did actually find residences and support systems for each of those people. And I would say from January until May of this year, the jungle was empty. And that was quite remarkable given the legacy of that. The jungle itself was a bit of community for homeless people, mm-hmm. supporting mm-hmm. each other.
And for those who don't know, it's located
kind of behind Wegmans, the inlet.
It's open wetlands, but
yes.
Kind of slightly above water level, but
yeah, on city land, but undeveloped
and railroad
city land.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right. And so Rescue Mission was invited because of their history in Syracuse to come down and give some advice, as these people who are very well intentioned, but we're not professionals in the field of issues of homelessness and all that comes with that. And so for, again, 18 months to 2 years, James Breslin from Auburn particularly came down and kind of went to the jungle, helped build those relationships, helped give support to the people who were trying to make a difference in making giving support to people who are moving out of homelessness. And then one particular person, Barry Siegel, decided, hey, there's this abandoned building that was the Red Cross shelter on Court Street. What if we get a lot of volunteers to help renovate that? And so we had this vision, and after about 4 months of over 200 volunteers and 2,000 hours of labor, they did transform that residence to a home-like setting for 10 men. And March 1st of this year, they opened up that residence, and I was asked to be the program manager for that. So that's what literally has happened in the last few months, as Rescue Mission was invited to the community and then has this presence. But I think the Rescue Mission in general wants to follow the community lead. What are the gaps? What are the needs? And how can we support people in this transition?
You're listening to Mike Koplinka-Lehr talk about his life and his work here in Ithaca. This is WRFI, Community Radio for Ithaca and Watkins Glen. And I'm Eric Clay, host of the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And we're going to continue on with the next segment of the interview with Mike Koplinka-Lehr, where he's going to talk about some issues that butt up against something that we care deeply about, the ability to just form relationships informally, which is what we can do on our own, versus the professionalized relationships where we need people with highly developed specialized skills, and how those two kinds of concerns have blended together in this work at the Rescue Mission and creating a shelter for men who have been homeless. And what you've just described is a really beautiful tension that often doesn't get held in tension, which is the Community Faith Partners folks are really adept at forming relationships across differences that often don't get bridged.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, can-do willingness to engage is oftentimes missing within a highly professionalized setting.
Yeah.
Now, the professional folks know what some of the systemic issues are, what some of the institutional issues are, but are often not adept at really just putting away all the formalities and just relating to people as equal human beings. And that's an interesting...
No, it's an interesting journey to walk, and we have to be able to open up our own lives, our own preconceptions. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to interact with people who are traditionally considered more at the margin, and what would it mean for ourselves to be at the margin? And I remember back in late 80s, I was working for LearningWeb, and I was, again, this bridge between the business community, the nonprofit community, and government sectors. Mm-hmm. I actually called this big meeting around youth apprenticeship, and what would we like to, you know, have employers have more youth in their businesses and explore. And it was a really eye-opening meeting, because in general, this is like 88, 89, many of the business community had not talked to nonprofits and had not talked to government. Horst Simon, actually, from up on the IC Hill, was the one who facilitated the meeting. But it's like these conversations were not happening at all. People were almost scared of, you know, nonprofits don't talk to the business community. Now, of course, it's more common because we actually have to rely on each other. But it's the same kind of thing. How do we, as a community, embrace people who are traditionally seen at the margin, whether it's a community with AIDS, or whether it's young people, or whether it's seniors who, you know, people who are traditionally in our socialized way, compartmentalized out of community? How do we bring them back in?
And I think I want to generalize this in a way that may push some boundaries too. We are all marginalized at one point or another in our own families or in our own residential communities because of our positions in conflict or the changes that we feel we need to go through and that we drag our families and friends through because of life events and whatnot. And being able to kind of be marginalized and reach out to others and to reach out to the marginalized, it's not a skill that exists well within our for-profit or not-for-profit communities because it involves opening up your life in some raw ways that we don't really know very well how to be community. It's the important struggle here, but I'm not yet convinced we really know what we're struggling with.
Oh, and you mentioned locally earlier in the show about being messy, you know, in the parent-child relationship, and that's exactly what we have to be willing to do. You know, Tompkins County is not that great at crossing these bridges yet, and I think we have to keep learning how to do that. And it's not an easy, as you say, it's not an easy skill to learn. We have to be able to look at what does it mean to be another. How do we previously conceive of the other? Because the other is not the other. The other is us.
And it's our projection of what they lack or what they have that we don't have, or who they are that we're not clear about.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to. you know, I haven't really spent a ton of time thinking about this, but, you know, as human beings, do we almost have a need to categorize we and they, the other and the in-group and the out-group? Because it seems from time immemorial we've been doing that, but it seems like we should be able to figure out ways to retrain ourselves, educate our young people as they're growing up that that's a false conception.
Right, and it does really nasty things to our ability to engage in important conflicts, because too many times we assume that our conflicts are with the other when our really important conflicts are with those inside our inside our we group and inside ourselves.
Yeah.
And that I think that may be the emotional structure of that division. But when we have to kind of say that all of our family and our friends and our community that are most dear are really the places that we're most willing to struggle for and fight for and realize that that struggle is raw, you know.
And you mentioned earlier in the show the father and son song, but that struggle between parent and child is perfectly emblematic, because as you're working with the issues your children are bringing to you, you actually have to face the issues inside yourself that you never dealt with. That's a perfect analogy, so to speak.
Well, the father and son thing is also true for my father and son relationship with my son. My father died when I was 7 years old, so lots of unfinished business in my growing up in the shadow of his myth, because he was a significant public figure, though a very poor farmer, but a public figure who had a persona in the community that that drew people to him as a mentor and as a friend and a companion, which I didn't get because he died. So that kind of set some stuff up and set me up to not really understand my own internal conflicts with my kid, with my son particularly, which is you're right on. How do we, you've talked about the other, but how is it that, to simplify this, what is your role as a program
manager
at the Rescue Mission Residence for Men? How does that kind of play out with thinking about differences and helping people span them?
Yeah, great question. I have probably three or four roles. One simply is what you might call traditionally case manager, to actually meet some of the needs day to day, whether it's a van ride to a medical or employment opportunity, or whether it's just keeping the house, helping to have the rules of the house be obeyed and keep the house clean and all those kinds of things. I have another role of looking across the community as to what the needs are and seeing what the developmental challenges are around homelessness. So what gaps are there? We already have long-standing groups in the community, the Homeless and Housing Task Force. There's a continuum of care committee. There's a group that's been meeting almost weekly since February called the Homeless Solutions Team. These are long-standing committees of people who are looking at the gaps in services, and part of my role is to interface with those from the Rescue Mission perspective and say, how might we be contributing to filling those gaps in whatever way. And that's individual conversations, but it's also county-wide conversations around what needs are there. So there's a fundraising role there. But then there's also a role, as you mentioned, about looking at the other. How do I assist our own community as a program manager? And of course, this is 10 men in a facility, but how do I assist our community in thinking about people who are traditionally seen as the other, seen as untouchables, possibly, seen as a challenging population that we don't necessarily have as much time for? How do we incorporate that into our community life in a way that we all can grow, that we all have a lot to learn from each other?
Right. I had an experience. I grew up in a place where the community was more high-functioning, and whereas the formal professionalized services were not so strong. But in a more high-functioning community, the person who was had some mental health issues, was a hermit, often in the woods, would come into town on a weekly basis, and people knew to pick up this fellow and bring him to the store and to take him back home. And that was kind of our committed role. And there were people who had specific needs that could be defined as the other, that everybody knew that if we didn't step up to the plate, they wouldn't be able to survive, let alone thrive.
And some mutual accountability.
Yes. And because, you know, and it was also awkward at times because this one of these people would had a hard time not going to the bathroom in the car because it was in a stressful time, an embarrassing time, and so they would ride in the back of the truck. I mean, there were attempts to be inclusive
accommodate,
but also to recognize that, you know, this doesn't necessarily smell good or sound good, but it's what we need to do,
and in
a functioning community, you know. You can look for the professional, but usually you just look, how can I do this, or how can I find somebody who can help me do this?
Yeah, and if you look at the global issues, you know, whether it's climate change or whether it's war, how do we have this community built around mutual support that takes into account those issues around resource management, around not hitting each other over the head, whether it's a bomb or whether it's a stick across the street. And I think those all feed into how we treat each other here in Tompkins County.
And behind what you're saying, there are essentially, I think, two principles. One is use as few resources as you possibly need.
And share resources.
And share resources, but also to fight openly, cleanly, and fairly, so that it doesn't resort to coercive tactics.
Yeah, and have skills that you can build community, you can communicate, as opposed to hitting each other.
right. But what I want to say here is that oftentimes we confuse with feel good, peacefulness, and that's bullshit. A community is where we willingly hurt because it matters.
Mm-hmm. Openly hurt.
Willing to be vulnerable. To the hurt, to both receive it and to inflict it for the right sorts of reasons, and where we have to make clear to others that our choices are not always the best choices, but they're our choices. And live with the consequences.
And that gets back to the father-son song around, you know, did we see that vulnerability modeled as we were, you know, because that's actually what young people are reaching out for. I want to see a piece of your humanity. I want to see your struggle, even though you seem very put together in your professional life.
And I also want to see you struggle to wrestle with me on the floor when I can now overpower you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's another piece of it, where it's not taking a stick, but it's really, and that physical force, especially for boys, men, and as they're kind of, you know, learning how to use the physicality. I think it's also true of girls. But we need to learn how to live within the physical bodies as well as our intellectual and emotional.
Oh, yeah. We've lost a lot of ritual in our community. Yeah. We've lost a lot of these transition, you know, coming of age ceremonies, all kinds of things that will assist in the community development and community working with each other.
I'm going to play your second song now because it's a kind of a good segue, and it's Our House by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long. Of you, and I
be so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. The flowers in the vase that you bought today.
This is WRFI Community Radio for Ithaca and Watkins Glen at 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. I'm Eric Clay, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging in deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And my guest this morning has been Mike Koplink-Allaire, well-known in the community for his work with the school board and also with county legislature, and now with the rescue mission. Our conversation at this moment is going to turn, in the next segment, is going to turn to more things having to do with the what's happening, how this home metaphor begins to play itself out. He's going to take up the story of the various homes he and Carrie and their children have had. One of the things about our house, which I think we'll get back to the our house being the whole house of the community, which I think is part of the appeal.
That's right.
To Mike. But I think Mike and Carrie have a very specific house that they have put together to lessen their impact on the environment. And one of your last comments in the last segment was that it's hard to know how to do community as well as how do you deal with these global issues. And yeah. So what is it about your house?
Well, it turns out we've had two iterations of house. We've had two houses. When we first got married, we were thinking of going out in the country and building a house. And someone, a friend of ours, said, you know, BOCES builds these demonstration houses as a way for young people to learn practical hands-on skills. And we actually bought a BOCES house and moved it down the street and lived on off of Warren Road, actually near BOCES. And that was a wonderful house. It was indeed a well-built demonstration house. It was meant to be passive solar, and at that time, you know, we were able to angle the house towards the sun. So for 25 years, that's where our kids were growing up. That was their house that was very solid, and we were warmed by the sun, and I can remember literally in the middle of winter playing in our swimsuits on our slate floor because it was so warm from the sun, and it was my way of getting them to wash the floor because they had spilled stuff, and we got in our swimsuits. But that was one way to, again, decrease our expenses. It was fairly modest house cost-wise, and with our own labor, put the other parts together. So then 25 years later, it turns out that Cornell students had designed a house. It was on another demonstration house. We can't seem to get away from these student-built operations. And that got moved down to Washington, D.C. for a competition known as the Solar Decathlon and brought back to Tompkins County. And through a variety of circumstances, we ended up with it, and we again had to put together kind of the kit of what the students had themselves built as a demonstration house. It was an off-the-grid house. It's a solar house, completely powered by the sun with photovoltaic cells for electricity and evacuated tubes for the heating source, for the hot water heating source, kind of like your furnace. And we found some land out in Lansing to move that to, and because we have four kids, we had to kind of increase the space beyond what the students had designed. But we've been living in that for 3 years and really enjoying the challenge. It feels like a bit of a spaceship because it was very high tech in some ways, but it also feels like very much going back to the land because you're very in touch with the seasons, the cycles, when the sun's going up and down, shoveling snow off the panels in the middle of winter so you actually have electricity, those kinds of things. So it's been quite a rewarding time for all our family, our kids included, because they helped build the additional part of the house that we had to build to house everyone. And the challenges of being a bit more weather and nature dependent. Mm-hmm. But going to the larger issue of our house as community, I would say, what does it mean for all of us to come back to this land again for centuries? First Nations peoples lived here, and what does it mean to be grounded in a piece of earth? Mm-hmm. To be how can we share this resource, whether it's the lake, although there's a mine under the lake, or our parks, or our own homes, open them up to each other's vulnerabilities, as we were talking earlier in the show, and realities, and yet also have a sense of safety and boundary. So those are large issues for our community to engage with. But as we talk about homelessness, mm-hmm. we talk about land and community, these are all very interrelated about, there's an organization called Building Bridges, which is trying to do some of these very things, reimagine our community based on equity, based on real jobs that pay you know, living wage with real skills, as opposed to shipping out and local food and all those kinds mm-hmm. of things. So we're really enjoying our house. We feel like we're living on the frontier mm-hmm. in two senses, the technological frontier of solar energy, but also back to land in terms of literally chopping wood because we put a masonry stove in our basement. And that song, Our House, talked about, I'll light the fire. And in the winter, we light the fire with what's called a Russian stove. So that keeps us warm from our own labor.
And technologically, that stove, you light it once and it goes for the next 24 hours.
Yeah. It just slowly emanates heat. It's a really wonderful, radiant type heat.
This is the Made of Clay Report, and we're talking with Mike Kuplinka-Lehr, and we're going to pick up again on the house in which we live, and the paid and unpaid labor and the work that we do to keep it going here in Ithaca, with some comments on some of the demographic challenges and the issues that we face. Now, I want to come back to something that you had said, and it's part of the tension of living in Ithaca, and most of our lives are spent in labor for which we are not paid.
Yes.
Whether we're studying or cleaning or taking care of children or taking care of older folks mm-hmm. or looking after things, most of our lives are spent in unpaid labor. And the one thing that you did that was a dramatic kind of shift with convention was you and Carrie decided that you would raise your kids by not being caught up in the paid labor mill.
Yes.
And you learning how to balance those things. There's a lot of value to unpaid labor just because it's not paid. So when we think about our work and our vocation, we need to think about how we balance those sorts of things. And so that's kind of one little footnote. It's how we do both, which is what's interesting about your life and interesting from my point of view mm-hmm. and interesting about the future for all of us. The other piece was kind of highlighted by Robert Putnam in an article in the New York Times yesterday, where he describes the town where he grew up in the 1950s, graduated from high school in the 1950s in northern Ohio, probably not far from Cleveland. And in those days, even the kids, the two African American kids in his school, the relatively poor kids, they were all seen as our kids, and it's a we, and these are our kids. Mm-hmm. The two African American kids in his class both went on to have graduate degrees and have professional careers, and some of the people didn't have those options who stayed back, but those who made it have continued to make it for generations. Mm-hmm. His point is now we have no sense of we. These are not our children. These are not our people, and we were so. One of the pieces of collateral damage of the 60s mm-hmm. was people would say, you can't say we because you can't speak for me.
Right.
And yet when you take away that ability to say, this is how I see us together, and you're kind of pushing the boundary to get us to think about a we again.
Well, it's challenging in a community with such high transition, right? Yeah. Every 4 years, you have a new cadre of students moving through.
Right, so we have a consistently, 30,000 people who consistently, maybe, let's say 35,000 if you consider the faculty or short-term mm-hmm. folks, too. 35,000 people who move through on a regular basis, but the rest are pretty stable.
Agreed. But because
70,000.
Because of that transition, though, I think we're always in a state of possible unsettledness regarding how much do we invest in the transition part and how much do we invest in the we of the permanent population and back and forth. You know, Cornell is kind of the big gorilla that people are trying to always understand and incorporate in the community, the town gown type issues, not just Cornell, but IC and TC3. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing struggle of how do we have as many of the people who are more transitional to still get engaged in the community and still find a sense of place, and how much do the people who are here on a more permanent basis decide they don't necessarily want to invest in a transitional relationship.
Right, and I guess In many ways, the colleges provide almost an instant community of peers for the students coming through. What's troubled me more over the years is that there are people who've been here for 10, 20, 30, 50 years, and this community is more atomized. The long-term residents don't know each other in more profoundly ignorant ways than any other place I've ever lived. Mm-hmm. Even in a neighborhood in the Bronx where, you know, we got to know each other in a variety of little ways across some profound differences, 18 different languages in a 72 apartment building in the, you know, next to the Bronx Zoo and the New York Botanical Gardens. But here, it's almost hard to get the conversations going. Almost hard, you know. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that partly it's the academic environment because people like to be quote expert, and so it's hard to again be vulnerable across and say what's real and going on in your life when you have this standard across the community that we have lots of experts who will shoot down something you say if you speak your mind.
So you have to have a high tolerance for conflict in order to speak up in the first place.
Yeah, and also skills to cross those boundaries and say, well, I may not be an expert, but also I do have opinions and I do want to get to know you and your kids. You know?
And your opinion matters to me and mine. It's important that you hear me.
Yeah.
Hard. Those are hard things to model and to.
But as you say, it's a lot of skill building,
and
willingness to even cross those boundaries. I'm not sure we're trained. You know, I think of our high school classes, so to speak. We're not necessarily trained in human relations and conflict management and these messy conversations.
We have, according to kind of the census stuff, we have Tompkins County is the 312th of 324 metropolitan areas in the U.S. So we are a small city, one of the smallest in the U.S., but we're a city, and people who come here from big cities see us as small towns, and people who come here from small towns see us as a fairly significant cosmopolitan
people from
city.
Large cities see us as rural.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so we are generally what you're not from, and that's kind of an interesting, ambiguous place to be. But one of the things that struck me in the last couple of years is we are less, in terms of this, the standard census categories of race, we're less diverse than the state of Kansas. We're about 80% white, non-Latino. We're about 9% Asian, about 5% African American, about 5% Latino. And a couple of percent of people from multiple identity groups. Kansas has 80% white, about 4 or 5% a Native American, 4 or 5% Asian, 5% African American, 5% Latino. So in a way, by those standards, we don't know how to live in this environment where we just don't have. You know, yes, there are structural issues of racism that need to be dealt with, but there are also issues about just numbers. You know, and then the other piece is that a third of our permanent workforce has to come in from out of the county, largely because they can't afford to live here. So how do you kind of these are those long term kind of structural issues which haven't really budged much. I mean, the Asian population has increased, but the others have been relatively low and relatively stable for a number of decades.
Well, I think in a strange way, the economic challenges that's, you know, the country and Tompkins County is a bit inured from it, but we still are facing it. Give us this great opportunity to say, okay, how do we build community when we're all being challenged economically or more economically and putting push to the margins? And, you know, are some of our larger economic systems beginning to collapse? And how we rely on each other more? So that may well be an entree to say, you know, I may be in a different neighborhood than you, but we have to begin to rely on you more. And whether it's through faith communities or whether it's through projects that you work side by side, things like addressing homelessness, or you mentioned affordable housing. You know, we have lots of people who are committed to expanding the affordable housing base in Tompkins County. That could put us more in contact with each other.
Right, but the scope of the problem is daunting because we could build one house for every four existing, and we would still just barely have met our discrepancy with our and that kind of change affects people's accumulation of wealth in their homes that they own. It affects all sorts of stuff. It's a It's a huge process.
But there are many, many people, just not to undermine, sure. that are very willing to be working on that.
Oh, yeah. They are.
We've seen that happening in the last, I would say, 10 years, of people really seeing these challenges and opportunities and working hard to cross those divides.
We're talking with Mike Kaplinka-Lehr, and on this particular day, we won't go into more detail about what those issues are and what we might do about them, but we may in the future if we have Mike back on the show again at some point. The last segment of the interview with Mike is one where he addresses what has surprised him living here and what has what continues to take him aback about being here. This is WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca. In your years of living and working here, what has surprised you most, both on the positive side and on the negative side? What's surprised you the most?
I would say racism is one of the things that has really jumped out at me and surprised me and still catches me out of breath so regularly.
Incidents you observe or realizing your own internal...
I would say the structural racism in our society, but also in this community. You think it's a very liberal, quote, progressive community, and yet we are so separate. We're unwilling to cross those divides for a variety of reasons. I mean, just kind of reading the other day about the institutions, you know, around, after Trayvon Martin, you know, are we going to... who's going to take charge of creating jobs? You know, everyone seems to be saying, well, that's somebody else's problem. It's not my problem. Well, guess what? It is all of us working together that needs to tackle these issues. And that was so dramatic with that decision. But here in Tompkins County, I think we have the opportunity to cross those divides. But that's been one that's been most surprising, and it still catches me off guard. I think there's also a long-term issue around... How we treat the what I would call First Nations populations here, because it basically was genocide. You know, we ended up buying some land out in Lansing, and I was very troubled by what do we do with land that really isn't our own? We have this economic system that says, quote, we own it. And my wife and I decided to put most of it into the land trust so that it will be used in perpetuity for future generations. But it's still a huge challenge given the geographic place that we live in and who
and almost all
here.
Of the land was by treaty.
That's right.
Supposed to be somebody else's land, but the treaties were
and you know, here we are at the 400th anniversary of some of those treaties. This very summer, and people are trying to bring that back to our consciousness.
So what's on the positive side?
I do think people build community. I think people have this, and I don't know if 100% is the cross community, but I think there's that will, and I would say it's kind of grounded in the spirituality of the place. It's grounded in the geography of the place. I don't know, maybe the hills separate us, but the hills also have a way to kind of can bring us together, whether it's the lake or something.
Right.
So and building community is a deep commitment across whether it's the farming community, the urban community, the economic imbalances. People do have this willingness. You look at the philanthropic community here. People keep giving and giving and giving. We've just had three major capital campaigns for theaters.
Right.
So,
a crisis has a way of making people vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And when 35% of your population is in perpetual moving and or death or birth of a child, these are major life changing jobs. Mm-hmm. These are major life crises, and those crises tend to make people vulnerable and interested in community and informal structures as their formal lives change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that also may be another way of framing it. Mike, it's been really good to talk with you this morning, and thank you for...
I look forward to talking some more.
Okay, good.